Welcome to The Tipping Point, a podcast by the Heinrich Böll Foundation. I'm your host, Katya Kumkova. In this episode, we're talking about a complicated system of permits and credits meant to tackle climate change. Unfortunately, as you will hear from our experts, turning these into a carbon market hasn't quite worked out.
For our luxury emissions, we're asking people to reduce the little bit of emission that they cause so we can feel good about carbon consumption.
If we think that the compensation will be creating problems elsewhere to other peoples, it's better not to buy this sort of compensation of the CO2.
Energy companies that are carbon majors finance a lot of groups, a lot of programs, a lot of pilot projects all on forests, but nobody discusses actually phasing out fossil fuels.
For a start, let's go back a bit. Remember when you first began to count? First your fingers, then your toys, and finally more grown-up things like money. Well, that was your introduction to one of the most basic principles of human civilization, counting and measuring. Now, apples and coins are pretty easy to count. But as a society, we've also set out to count more complex things, like the wealth of our countries, or the carbon dioxide we emit into the air. And if you can quantify something, you can also, eventually, turn it into a commodity that you can trade on a market. Right? Carbon markets have been created as instruments to curb climate change. The commodity traded on carbon markets is a license to pollute, or a carbon credit. But does one ton of carbon emitted in one place, say in a coal plant in Germany, really equal to one ton of carbon saved somewhere else, like the Amazon rainforest? Carbon trading is supposed to be a cheap and efficient way of limiting global warming. Dozens of emissions trading schemes have been set up around the world. But is carbon trading really that cheap? What are the hidden ecological and social costs? And who are the people benefiting or losing from it? In this episode, we'll be looking into the new carbon economy and the hugely controversial ethical questions it brings up. To learn more about carbon markets, we met with Jutta Kill. Jutta is a biologist from Germany and author of the book Trading Carbon, How It Works and Why It Is Controversial. She told us about the biggest carbon market in the world in the European Union.
We see that not only has complying with emissions limits been cheap for the industry, it has been a profit maker for the largest polluters in Europe. From around 2008 until 2014, the largest polluters in the European Union have made profits worth more or less 24 billion euros from the emissions trading scheme. 24 billion. Polluters are not paying. They are being paid. The emissions trading scheme in the EU really has turned into a corporate welfare scheme.
Wait a minute. Isn't a carbon market supposed to make polluters pay? That was the initial idea of carbon trade. For every ton of CO2, companies are supposed to hand in a carbon permit, which costs money. To save expenses, the companies would then find ways to reduce their emissions, for example, by introducing better technology. But carbon permits in the EU market aren't costly at all. They've been handed out for free to the biggest polluters. The idea was to get the industry on board by first giving out free allowances. Over time, the number of permits would be reduced, and with them, the overall emissions in Europe. But the industry was able to trick the system. Their lobbyists successfully negotiated for more permits than they would actually need.
All of them had huge expansion plans. All of them were foreseeing that their production would go up a lot in the coming years, and that they needed, therefore, a lot of free permits. In the course of the years, it turned out that those projections were hugely, but hugely, overestimated, and that the real emissions were much lower. Then came the economic crisis, and the emissions were lower even yet. But instead of the emissions trading scheme having a mechanism that says, okay, if you don't use those permits at the end of the year, you give them back if you were wrong with that projection, the emissions trading scheme was revised so that the permits would keep being valid, and there was no expiry date, so to speak, and the companies could keep them.
With this huge number of extra permits, the companies were able to make billions on the EU carbon market. This turned the idea upside down. There were too many permits, the price of pollution fell, and instead of reducing or paying for its pollution, the industry even profited. Oh, and just in case they needed extra permits, they could buy them cheaply outside the European Union, as so-called carbon offset credits. You might have run across them, for example, when booking a flight. The point is that you contribute to a project that saves the same amount of CO2 that you emit. To evaluate this strategy, Jutta Kill visited some of these carbon offset projects with Fern, an environmental NGO devoted to forests. One of the projects, for example, was claiming to bring new climate-friendly cooking stoves to local people in the Indian state of Rajasthan.
We were led into the kitchen and we saw a big pile of wood tucked away in a corner, obviously not for us to see, but we happened to notice it was there. And talking to a little girl of the family, we asked her what they were doing with this wood. And she said, "Oh, we only use that now for very special meals." And curious as we were, we said, "Like, special meals like what?" And her response was, "Meals like chapatis." Now, chapatis are a staple food in Indian cooking, particularly in the Indian rural cooking.
The project had claimed to save emissions by supplying modern cooking stoves. Using the new stoves, Rajasthani families could save firewood and thus trees. And since trees take up carbon dioxide, they would have saved emissions.
The wood stoves are still used on a daily basis, but the consequence of this carbon offset project was that a little girl was made to lie to international visitors to pretend that the project was saving all the carbon emissions like presented in the report. And I think that was one of the sad stories, one of the sad examples. Not only was it not helping climate change, but also this perversity of making a small child lie.
The project obviously didn't fit the culture and needs of the local people. If your bread tastes better with your traditional fire, why use the new oven? And meeting the little girl in Rajasthan was not the only problem Jutta saw firsthand. On one occasion, she was able to visit a project in Uganda. A carbon credit company had planted eucalyptus trees around a national park. However, the local villagers considered this their territory and refused to stop planting their crops there.
The result of the carbon offset project was that armed guards that were partly guarding the national park, but also now guarding the tree planting of the offset project, destroyed the crops and even shot at people who were entering the national park, their land. People lost any means of providing their food, any way of growing their own food. And if you have very little, losing the little that you have really is a problem. This carbon offset project really caused misery for local communities. Again, for what? So that an audience in Amsterdam can enjoy a carbon neutral classical concert. Nothing against classical concerts, but that we pretend there have been no carbon emissions for that pleasure. Because somebody somewhere else, a community that has contributed really nothing to the problem of climate change, loses the basis for its livelihood?
After her visits and research, Jutta came to a conclusion. These carbon offsetting projects clearly cause more harm than good. But on top of that, there's a conceptual flaw in the whole idea.
How does a project know how many emissions it has reduced and how many carbon credits it can sell? So it asks the consultant to calculate how big the emissions would have been in the future without the carbon project. Now, that's a very hypothetical calculation because the future doesn't happen because the carbon offset project happens. The consequence of that is that you never know if the carbon credit that you're buying to compensate your emission really is backed up by a reduction that wouldn't have happened anyways.
The same problem arises with other greenhouse gases, or gases that trap heat in the atmosphere. These can be traded as so-called CO2 equivalents, because some of them have a global warming effect many times greater than CO2, conserving just a little bit can create huge numbers of credits and therefore profit. This seems to have happened in the nylon industry, which was producing apatic acid, another element that causes the emission of nitrous oxide, a powerful greenhouse gas. For the producers, it was cheap to reduce these emissions and to get huge numbers of carbon credits in return. This created an absurd set of business incentives.
The value of the byproduct that they were now capturing and selling, the non-release as a carbon credit, turned out to become the main product, because you could make more money selling your carbon credits than you could make from producing your main product. The perverse result of that was that they increased production, not because there was demand for more apatic acid for nylon production. They increased production because they could make money from selling carbon credits.
You're listening to The Tipping Point. In this third episode, we're discussing the promises and failures of the carbon market. As we just learned from Yuta Kill, the attempt to offset emissions often creates problems of its own. At least some credit-earning projects don't really help the climate. Instead, they hurt the livelihoods of local people. This also happens in South America. In Ecuador, one of the women speaking out against these practices is Yvonne Yanez, who works for the environmental organization Acción Ecológica. We reached Yvonne in her office on a busy day in the city of Quito.
All the creators and promoters of this type of mechanisms, what they are presuming is that the non-humans, the other that are not non-humans and the so-called nature or natures in plural, they are providers of ecosystem services, providers of a service that can be converted in a commodity and then can be sell, buy, speculate in the financial markets, etc. But at the same time, this means that the cycles, the functions, the elements, the recreation of life become a commodity that can be put in the markets.
The notion of ecosystem services forms the basis of much of the carbon credit market. It reduces nature to an entity that mainly serves us, humans. But in Ecuador, nature has been granted its own constitutional rights. According to the Ecuadorian constitution, nature should be able to exist, persist, maintain, and regenerate its vital cycles. This applies to Páramo, one of the unique ecosystems of the Andes and home of the indigenous Quechua people. High up in the mountains of Ecuador, the Páramo forms a green landscape of moist, low-growing vegetation. One day, a Dutch company came and convinced the Quechua to set up a pine tree plantation to generate carbon credits.
But this was very bad for the community because what happened is that the community must spend a lot of time and put in money from them in order to keep the plantations clean, or also they have to prevent any damage to the planted trees, for example, plagues or even fires.
The Quechua soon realized that the pine plantation was not only hard to maintain, it also damaged the Páramo ecosystem and its water cycle. Until then, the landscape had been lush with moisture from the glaciers and water from the mountains. Now, pine trees were covering the soil, absorbing excess water, and blocking off light for native plants that played a crucial role for the region's water cycle. One day, an old man went up to perform a ritual. On his way back, he forgot to blow out the candles. A huge fire blazed on the Páramo, and the entire plantation burnt down. With it went all the carbon it had taken up so far. Again, the project hadn't helped the climate, but caused problems for the locals. Yvonne talks about another case from the Brazilian Amazon, where a tree planting program led to conflict among the local people.
And this community decided that they didn't want it anymore, this project. They said that the money was causing problems with the communities, divisions, fights, And they were spending too much time protecting these forests that were forbidden for them to use anymore as a traditional way. They didn't could go in and hunt and harvest or make some cultures there, agricultural cultures, because this part of the forest now was under a property right regime of environmental services that belong to the companies that were giving the money to the community.
In the global carbon market, it's often the people who have contributed least to climate change who are supposed to make up for it. They're asked to turn their traditional land and culture into what's dubbed a carbon sink. By doing this, they enable the global north to continue emitting greenhouse gases. To Ivan Yanez, that's neocolonialism at best, and perhaps even worse.
Indigenous peoples are the ones that will suffer in terms of their collective rights violations, and instead of a change of the model of production in the north, all of these problems and the responsibilities are put in the hands of the indigenous people, the campesinos, the fishermen, etc., in the world. So for me, this is absolutely racist.
Dealing with climate change in terms of carbon causes conflicts. In Brazil, Camila Moreno from the Federal Rural University of Rio de Janeiro is looking at the new paradigm of carbon metrics. In 2016, we met her at the United Nations Climate Summit in Morocco.
The CO2 metric that we criticize, it damages the protection of forests and reduces it to carbon sinks to fit in wider engines of speculating with the climate, connecting forest with the financial markets, issuing green bonds and carbon credits and all kinds of things.
For accountants and traders, CO2 is an ideal entity, emitted here and saved some somewhere else. Here, carbon dioxide is released when fossil fuels and trees are burnt. Elsewhere, carbon dioxide is captured by nature itself when plants photosynthesize. One of the places where both processes are happening at the same time is the Amazon. The lush vegetation of the tropical rainforest constantly removes huge amounts of CO2 from the air and stores some of it in roots and stems. But when trees are felled and burnt, the carbon is released instead. This is why the fight against deforestation is so important. For some time, the Brazilian government was able to crack down on illegal logging. But then, the Amazon Forest Code was changed, says Camila Moreno.
The fundamental thing it did was to transform the illegality in a legal deforestation and to open up for market mechanisms, for flexibility. So if you are a big landowner and you have deforested beyond what you are allowed to do, you can buy the avoided deforestation elsewhere, you know, the rights of somebody else to deforest that were not used yet. So this, although it makes for the market-minded people logic in terms of cost-effectiveness allocation, locally it destroys livelihoods, it misuse equivalences of CO2, saying that you can destroy one ecosystem but at the same time preserving the other. So who said that? Who decided which one has the right to live and which one has the right to be destroyed? And we could never forget, or should always remember, that there are people living in those ecosystems. And when we destroy them, we are destroying traditional knowledge that only exists as long as the ecosystem is there.
To critics like Camila, the carbon market is a questionable instrument in the fight against climate change. The root of the climate crisis is clear, but the global climate talks have avoided it like an elephant in the room.
See, within the current climate negotiations, people are discussing how to sink, how to offset emissions with forests, on housing, with health, with education, with agriculture, with infrastructures. They talk about everything and they try to implement climate policy related to every single area of people's lives. The only thing that they are not talking here is to stop using fossil fuels.
The strategy against climate change has focused on emissions and not the process of production that causes them. Instead of deciding to close coal mines and leave gas and oil reserves in the ground, an intricate credit system was created. It evolves around the idea of carbon as a tradable good and effectively enables the fossil industry to continue. For her part, Ivan Yanez is convinced that the Paris Agreement will only make things worse.
I really think that the Paris Agreement will not be good at all for climate. I mean, all of these promises of 1.5, 2.5, I think that they just wanted to put a sort of number because they had a lot of pressure from the international community. So the governments and the representatives said, okay, we are going to put these degrees. Of course, they are real degrees that we have to achieve, but they were forced to say that they are going to achieve this. But at the same time, with the national promises and with the creation of a global market of carbon through the mechanisms that are set in the Paris Agreement, climate change will be worse.
Carbon markets haven't worked so far. On the contrary, they've caused conflict for poor communities and threatened ecosystems. And they've been misused to make huge profits. To biologist Yuta Kill, the idea of carbon trading has steered the discussion into the wrong direction.
The introduction of emissions trading in the Kyoto Protocol has distracted the discussion for 20 years away from the main problem, and that is the continuation of burning fossil carbon through petrol, through coal, through natural gas.
We get lost in counting CO2 and don't see the full picture. Carbon credits from projects in the global south can't offset the damage done by pollution in the north. In fact, the trading may be doing more harm than good. Ivan Yanez says that the people in the richer countries need to realize their responsibility and act.
It's not only now. I think that we have to think that these problems are coming since many years ago, more than 100 years ago, or at least even more than after the Second World War, when the capitalism and this economic system really expanded everywhere with new frontiers everywhere. So I think that in the North, it's important to think that it's not a question that to be a good consumer and consume locally and consume organic or whatever it is, but also to take a conscience that there is an ecological debt that should be recognized and also to be repaired with the southern peoples in the world.
The true keepers of forests are those who've been living there for generations. They know how to take care of the land, to sustainably farm it, and preserve its diversity and potential. It is these people's livelihoods that are being threatened by the same industry that is driving deforestation: industrial agriculture, industrial logging, and large infrastructure projects like mining. But rather than give up this kind of development, we in the global north often blame local populations for protecting their land.
Yeah, the best way to preserve forests is to guarantee the rights of people that live in the forest. So indigenous territory, the local communities, riverine communities, as in the case for the Amazon Basin, peasants, small agricultures. So they are the ones that have traditionally learned and lived with the ecosystems without destroying the ecosystem and rebuilding it as a giant monoculture. So we have to address the expansion of agribusiness everywhere.
And I think that this communities, instead to be criminalized, instead to be their leaders put in jail, etc., I think that there should be recognized that they are the leading people that are fighting climate change and fighting for a change of civilization.
So here's the answer to our question from the beginning. Can trading fix climate change? Now, judging by the experiences we just heard about, the answer is clearly no. Carbon trade has not been able to make pollution pricey enough to keep us away from our fossil fuel addiction, nor does it actually address the drivers of deforestation. Even worse, in numerous cases, this approach seems to cause more harm than good. In our later episodes, we'll keep exploring better solutions. This was The Tipping Point with me, Katya Kumkova. Thanks for listening. You can find all our episodes at bl.de/tipping. tipping point. That's boell.de/tipping point. The music for this episode comes from Crinkles. It's released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution Only license. Stay tuned for our next installment. We'll be looking at the impacts of industrial agriculture on our soil and the role of farming in saving the global climate. Until then, bye-bye.